Hey, y'all. I'm late, but I'm here. Wherever here is, somewhere. All right, y'all. It's the show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Yeah, it's the dang show. Today on the show, Jim Loeb is going to be here. He's the world's foremost expert on the neocons, if you ask me. He's been writing about the neoconservative movement for 35 years. Something like that. So he'll be on to talk about their various reactions to the possibility, I won't call it the promise, the possibility of a nuclear deal with the Iranians. Oh, no, them warmongers don't like that. They rather monger a war than make a peace, you see. So Jim Loeb will be on to talk about that, and Jason Leopold will be back on the show. He's been suing the government lately for, everything, but mostly Guantanamo documents, I think. And by sue, I mean Freedom of Information Act. That's what he does. Files FOIAs, and then he writes about the government documents that he gets there at america.aljazeera.com. And you know what? I know that he got in trouble for a story that wasn't right back in 2006 about Karl Rove being indicted, and people still actually make a big deal about that, believe it or not, from time to time. But the thing of it was, to me, I thought, you know, the lesson more than anything else was what a bunch of little snakes and rats the Democrats are. And I don't mean the politicians, I mean the Daily Coast kids. I mean the Democratic rank and file. Oh, did they all, and for that matter, you know, well, anyway, it was spread far and wide, the number of people who raced to throw Jason Leopold under the bus. Who, me? I never quoted an article by him. No, I hate him even more than you. Dur, 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 they all raced to claim. And yet, what was it that he did so wrong? He got a story wrong. He believed a source and published what his source told him when he shouldn't have believed that source. In fact, I think the wife's version is the source lied to him. I don't know all the details, but the source lied to him. He didn't lie about what the source told him. In fact, no, her version is somebody had lied to the source because they knew that the source was leaking to Leopold. And they wanted the source to leak the wrong thing to him. Something like that. Anyway, the point is, he didn't just make it up. It's not like he was Jason Blair just pretending things and writing it in the story. And it's not like he was Michael Gordon just taking lies directly from David Petraeus and printing them with no verifiable fact behind them whatsoever and trying to lie us into a war with anonymous quotes about, oh yeah, if a bomb blows up on the side of a road in Iraq, then that proves that that bomb must have come from Iran. Print that. Or Judith Miller publishing stories handed to her by the Iranian spy Ahmed Chalabi because she, like the rest of the neocons, believed that the war in Iraq would be good for Israel, which I guess it could from a certain hateful, horrible, right-wing nationalist Likud party point of view, but anyway. I just think it's funny in a way. I mean, poor guy, right? He screwed up a story and got nailed to the wall over it. But everybody pretended, all the left-wingers who should have loved Leopold and should have rushed to his defense, all raced to accuse him, all raced to distance themselves, all raced to say, oh, I never did like that guy or believe him, and yeah, he's a big liar and whatever. Even though nobody ever reported as a credible fact based on multiple sources that he made it up. It was just that he got it wrong. And anyway, all it was that he got wrong was that Rove was indicted for being part of the plane leak. Well, so what? He was part of it. Him and Libby conspired together to leak the leak, so whatever, dude. Who cares if he's indicted or not? The guy lied you into war with Iraq quite deliberately and got 1 million people killed. That's a crime, and I don't care what the grand jury says about it. How do you like that? I'm my own single source for that. Oh, no, I got Walter Pincus writing in the Washington Post about the White House Iraq group that Karl Rove was the director of. And their only job was lying you into war. Well, you know, you don't want to debut a new product before Labor Day, said Andrew Card, who sat at Rove's right hand on the White House Iraq group. But just wait, because after Labor Day, we have this whole propaganda campaign ready for you and waiting. Anyway, I just think it's, it's sad that Leopold, his career really did suffer for that mistake. And hey, he made a mistake, you got to pay the consequences, whatever. But the lesson there about, so-called alternative media on the left and how quickly they will race to pretend that they're the mainstream, you know? Let me at him, Uncle Scooby. I'll take him for you. Yeah, anyway, I like Jason Leopold. I think more than 99% of what he writes is just fine. And again, when he screws up, it's not like he's lying us into a war like every mainstream reporter in America. I mean, you know, if it wasn't for the First Amendment, and if there was a rule of law, and if there was a law that said that, you know, if you're like Goebbels and what you do is not journalism, but it's just war propaganda for the state, and your job is lying people into war, then the editors of the New Yorker magazine would be doing life in prison right now. You realize that? Do you realize the role that the New Yorker played in letting Jeffrey Goldberg lie the American people into war in 2002 and 2003? You know, at Nuremberg, the Goebbels and his henchmen, who did nothing but lie to the people of Germany all day to propagandize them into war, they were held accountable for that. That wasn't freedom of speech. Just think of the people at the New York Times who would be doing life in the Supermax prison if there was such a thing as legal accountability for telling lies with consequences in the New York Times. All Jason Leopold's guilty of is getting some people's hopes up, right? What? Rove is indicted? Aw. Damn. That sucks. In fact, you know what? Now that I think about it, I'm really mad at that Leopold. I don't really remember whether my hopes were up or not at the time. I might have found out about the whole thing after the fact or something, but just now thinking about it, I'm upset at him. Man, that's not right, going around getting people's hopes up that Rove could possibly be prosecuted for anything, ever. Come on. Everybody should have known better than that. He should have not believed his sources when they said that. The federal prosecutors indicted the president's best friend and right-hand man. Really? Nuh-uh. It doesn't quite ring true to me. Although, Cheney's best friend and right-hand man, so that is kind of a big deal. You know, I don't know. Libby was, in fact, indicted, so. All right. Well, anyway, there's a story, by the way, speaking of lawlessness for war crimes, from Ben Smith at BuzzFeed. Waterboarding is a big joke at the Cheney Roast. A sentimental evening at the Plaza for Cheney, Rumsfeld, Mukasey, and Lieberman. Really tasteless, says a guest. Well, before we get too far into this, let me just remark real quick that, yeah, any single count of waterboarding is torture, and Cheney ought to be doing life in prison for it. No doubt about it. However, I want you to understand, you know, assuming you'd take my word for it, maybe you'd have to go study it up a little bit better. But anyway, I think it's a gigantic, horrible, modified, limited hangout propaganda campaign to get you to focus on waterboarding when there are only somewhere around 3 Al-Qaeda guys waterboarded. Zubaydah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Ramzi bin al-Shib, and then maybe a couple others. Maybe a few others, even. It's possible that they lied about it a little bit, didn't really tell the whole story. And yeah, it's true, Marcy Wheeler figured out that they actually, despite what you may have heard, they waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times in a month. That's a lot of waterboarding. But anyway, and I, personally, I don't care what anyone does horrible to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, although I do have a problem with the people being legalized to do horrible things to him. I don't think that they should have those jobs. Not that I would lament any pain and suffering on his part. But anyway, the waterboarding thing is a giant red herring, because here's the fact. Are you ready? The United States government, the CIA, and the military tortured tens of thousands of people. Tortured tens of thousands of Afghans and Iraqis over the last dozen years. What happened was, they ruled, they just made up this whole thing where the Geneva Conventions don't apply. The world law that America made up to apply to the rest of the planet doesn't apply to us. Doesn't apply to the people who we're abusing. They have no rights. We have unlimited, plenary, inherent presidential authority to grab whom you must, do what you want. And the CIA and the Pentagon both had secret programs in Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, and their ghost prisons around the world and everything else to torture people within an inch of their life. In many cases, to death. More than 100 people were tortured to death. I think they say only 2 or 3 of them by the CIA. It could have been more than that. Most of them by the military. But more than 100 of them were tortured to death, but tens of thousands of them were tortured. There was no any kind of what could even be considered somewhat legitimate prisoner of war or legal status of any kind for captured Iraqis. It all just during the Iraq occupation. They suffered the worst brunt of it all, of course. And as Tony Lugaranis put it to PBS on the documentary, The Torture Question. Oh, we torture them in their houses. We torture them at their businesses. We torture them on the side of the road. We torture them and then we shot them. We all tortured them. And boy, Stanley McChrystal and all those guys at Camp Nama, they called it. Joint Special Operations Command. Yeah, they were torturing people. And then, of course, Captain Fishback talked about the base, I think up near Mosul, where what happened was, this is so typical of government, too, and especially the military. They make up this new jargon, this new speak, military talk, and they start calling the people that they've kidnapped PUCs. P-U-C stands for Person Under Control. Well, so what happens is they go from being a person under control to a puck. Well, what the hell is a puck? A puck is not anything. A puck sure as hell doesn't have any rights. And so, come on, let's torture some pucks. And so that's what they would do. Didn't even have to call him a gook, right? Didn't even have to call him a camel jockey or some kind or a haji or some kind of presumably racist term. Of course, haji is actually an honorific for someone who's gone to Mecca. But anyway, They didn't even have to call them some dehumanizing racist slur. They just called them by their acronym. Hey guys, I'm gonna go smoke a puck. And that meant was tie one up and burn him. Or I'm gonna go beat a puck meant wrap him up and then use him for a heavy bag. And on like that. And anyway, they completely suspended any pretense of law and they tortured tens of thousands of people. So don't let them distract you with waterboarding. Oh, boo-hoo, Dick Cheney waterboarding three of the most horrible stateless terrorists in the world. Wah, you all say. Well, I say no, they tortured tens of thousands of people. And all of them innocent of having anything to do with attacking the United States of America. I mean, other than those three. Maybe another handful of the CIA prisoners. Not like them being guilty means that they should be sentenced to torture or anything. Of course, Antonin Scalia, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, said, hey, the Eighth Amendment bans cruel and unusual punishment, not cruel and unusual interrogation. So, all right. He's got you there, I guess. Anyway, they did a roast of Dick Cheney last night, and they were all cracking jokes about war crimes, about torture. And Cheney made jokes about waterboarding himself. To paraphrase Joe Lieberman, he, quote, said, this is someone else paraphrasing him, Joe Lieberman said something to the effect that it's nice that we're all here at the plaza instead of in cages after some war crimes trial. Recalled one person who was there. And that's it. They're just yucking it up. And you know, here's what's funny about it, right? Is it is a big joke that the law could ever apply to the former vice president of the United States of America. Or a former senator like Joe Lieberman. Or even their underlings, the help, like Karl Rove, who helped run the White House Iraq group, or Doug Feith, who ran the Office of Special Plans over in the Pentagon, or George Tenet, who said, it's a slam dunk. Not that they have weapons of mass destruction, but it's a slam dunk that you'll be able to convince the American people that they have weapons of mass destruction. Well, that's his excuse anyway. I never said they had the weapons. I said you'll be able to lie to the people that they have the weapons, sir. The idea that they could ever be held accountable, any of these men. Colin Powell, who went knowingly lying, according to his own right-hand man, Colonel Wilkerson, knowing he was lying, going to the United Nations and putting out that dossier. For that matter, speaking of dossiers, that the law could possibly ever apply to Tony Blair or any of the people who helped him lie the people of England into a war. The war. It is a joke. It sounds silly, doesn't it? To think that ever, in 100 years, the rule of law could ever be applied to the leaders of this government. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy. And all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. And you know, I know it sounds childish to talk about the law not applying to leaders with power and whatever, but that's my point. Just how ridiculous it is. The theory that the law could ever bind the power of the leaders of the executive branch of this country. You know, they put Lindy England in jail for humiliating Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. But everybody who ordered her to do it got away scot-free. And by the way, never mind the United Nations or any international treaties, torture is illegal under American law. This is already a crime. And there's not an exemption in there for if you sort of kind of won an election one time, then you get to torture whoever you want. It doesn't say that. It's a felony. I'll tell you what. You kidnap Dick Cheney and torture him and see if they prosecute you. Right, they'll prosecute you under the torture statutes that say that it's against the law to torture somebody. And yes, that was a suggestion. Please, go right ahead. I mean, just to test my legal theory. So anyway, I'm not saying that you're free. This isn't that kind of lawless society where, yeah, you do whatever you want. Oh, no, no. There are laws that the government can use to invoke as their excuses to persecute you if they want. I'm just saying there is not a rule of law at all. There's really no law, just laws. And, yeah, we've taken, what, a tenth of a step from, you know, progress-wise from the pharaohs of ancient Egypt here. Oh, but look, we have regular elections. We get to pick our pharaoh, who then gets to do whatever he wants with us. Okay. I know, I'm pretty impressed too. And by the way, speaking of the lawlessness and all of that, how can it be that everybody doesn't hate the government as much as me? I can't understand this. These guys are torturers and killers, man. And, I mean, obviously TV has a very pro-government bias in every way, but, you know, on my Twitter feed too, I see people are really upset about the government shutdown. And I don't just mean they're upset at the way that the government is applying it and saying, oh, gee, yeah, the national parks are closed, but somehow the cops whose job it is to turn you away, they're all still on duty. Yeah, some shutdown. You know, you would think that a government shutdown would mean you could just walk right in. No, they've got enough cops to keep you from walking right in, but that's all. And anyway, but besides that, I don't just mean that, the way they're abusing the government shutdown, actually using their state power to prevent people from doing things. I saw one this morning trying to close down some guy's restaurant. There's a private restaurant on national park land, something like that, probably, right? Anyway. But no, it's not just that. People are actually upset, not just about any, you know, small individualized consequences of the shutdown, but they're actually upset about the shutdown. They're saying, you know, this is totally not us Republicans' fault. Barack Obama refuses to meet us at the table and negotiate. And then the Democrats say, well, you know, these Republicans, they just won't accept defeat on the thing that they got defeated on, and now they're trying to be unfair, and so we don't want to negotiate with them, or maybe we will. And then people on the outside are saying, Oh my God, look at these Democrats. Look at the president refuses to negotiate with the Republicans. God, he is such a lousy president. And then on the other side, they go, these Republicans, they're so mean and right-wing that they just can't compromise in the democracy and make the deal and fund the government. And I feel alone. I almost want to start crying. A shutdown of the government is the best thing that's happened all year, except for that time that Vladimir Putin prevented America from launching a war against Syria. Other than that, because still, I mean, the talks with Iran, a deal with Iran, that's still just a possibility. I have to go with government shutdown as second best thing that's happened all year long. Are you kidding me? You're upset that they're not passing a budget? You're upset that they're not funding the national government, the biggest, most violent, most corrupt force in the whole world? Oh, boo-hoo. If only all these government employees could go back to work. I don't get it. I just don't get it. And I try hard. I'm not the best. But I try really hard to put myself in somebody else's shoes, you know? Well, what if I wasn't really a political guy and I was just an air conditioner repairman for a living? I might say to myself, yeah, the government shut down. Shut down even more of it. And sooner. Right? I can't imagine. I can't imagine not celebrating the shutdown of the government. I could be a furloughed government employee talking about, and I get back pay for all this. So who cares? Keep it shut down, right? Even from the point of view of the bureaucrats, it's great. It's not like they're not getting a paid vacation here. And I did see a thing that said that the National Institute of Health has now called off a study. And there's a woman with cancer who might die of her cancer now because the newfangled cancer drug that they wanted to test on her, that study's been called off. And listen, I mean, that's bad. But again, they're not closing down all kinds of stuff at the Institute for Health. They're closing down the stuff that hurts the public the most to try to make their point of how bad you need them. But why would anybody need the National Institute of Health to be the ones that carry out the study in the first place? You're telling me no one else in America can figure out how to make money testing this drug? How about the company that invented it? Or are you telling me that the laws that prevent private industry from testing these drugs on these very same subjects, that those laws are not shut down this week? That all those felony statutes will still be enforced, all those regulations will still be enforced? Sorry, lady, no one else can test this drug on you either. Die, says the state. And then it's the shutdown of the state that's to blame? I don't think so. You know, go ahead and point your finger and call a murderer a murderer. It's pretty obvious who's the murderer here. You know, like taxpayers owe every cancer patient a government-funded cancer study. You know, what the people of America owe the cancer-ridden is a government that will leave them alone so that they can get better. You know, freedom. I don't know if anybody knows how to provide that for them, but... Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, you own a business?
maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, welcome back to the show. I should have learned how to play guitar instead of reading all this crap. Hey, that song wasn't supposed to cut off so abruptly like that. You'll cut off when I tell you to. And by the way, bumper music playing machine, you didn't play my outro music, did you? I didn't hear any outro music, did you guys? There's supposed to be outro music. Anyway, so, yeah, I don't know. Who's to blame for the government shutdown? How about who gets credit for it? It's the best thing the Republicans and Democrats ever did was be such pigs that they couldn't figure out how to get along, you know, well enough on screwing us all. So their combined efforts failed, ground to a halt. Oh, you know, of course, except the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and Homeland Security and the DEA and the Pentagon to local police department military equipment program and the federal prosecutors and all the U.S. attorney's offices and the, oh yeah, their power to crush you to dust is all still in complete effect. None of that has been shut down. Oh, they cry boo-hoo that, oh, we can't fly our jet fighters and, oh, we had to furlough some cops. Yeah, right. Don't you believe it for a minute that they would suspend any of their killing power. Yeah, they'll close your national park. Oh, God, I hate those Republicans for closing the national park. Yeah. And that's the sad thing, right? Is this is working on people, too. That Barack Obama, he refuses to negotiate with the Republicans. You people just repeat whatever, not you people, I'm sorry, everybody except you people. Just repeat whatever talking point they put in your brain like a minor bird. Well, I say we go get Saddam and get out. Yeah, well, that's actually not what they're selling right now. They're selling let's go get Saddam and stay forever. So, you can call it whatever you want, but that's what you're giving them permission for, dummy. Well, I think that Obama is not doing a good enough job negotiating with the Republicans. Well, I think the Republicans just hate poor people, and that's why they keep the national park closed all the time. And yeah. You know what? It's like Jim Bovard said, and he was talking about the Republicans and the Democrats, the party. I'm talking about the rank and file. He was talking about the party in power in Congress. I believe specifically on the Waco hearings, he said it was like watching drunks fight in a bar. They swing and they miss. Nobody gets to the bottom of anything and nobody does anything right. Sounds about right to me. Speaking of which, isn't it funny that Michelle Bachmann is a person? And, you know, I don't know. You don't hear me criticize people's religious beliefs on the show very much, and I don't have any religious beliefs. But I don't really mind other people having them, you know, because first and foremost, I believe in liberty. And of course, you own your own brain and your own conscience, and you can believe whatever you want. It's fine. And honestly, I can't find any set of religious beliefs that I find to be any more believable than any other. So, you know, what am I going to do? Spend all day attacking every different kind of belief system in the world? Who cares, right? You know? But what's interesting and notable to me anyway is how people act on their beliefs, to plagiarize Bill Hicks. I do plagiarize Bill Hicks from time to time. Usually not jokes, though. Usually just a little turn of phrase like that. And usually when I realize I'm doing it, I try to give him credit, you know, best I can. How people act on their beliefs. You know, pro-lifers, murdering doctors, that kind of thing. Anyway, so here's Michelle Bachmann, and she's an actual congressperson in America. And not for long, because she's so corrupt, she's got to not run for Congress again. Because of stealing and law-breaking and stuff. But anyway, She gave this interview where she says that Obama's funding of terrorists in Syria is proof that we are living in the end times. Now, I had a few things to say about that. First of all, come on, the whole rapture thing and all that, that was invented by the Darbyites only, what, like 130 years ago or 140 years ago or something like that. Okay? So the fact that nobody believed that from the time of Christ all the way up through the 19th century means it's just some made-up crap, okay? I'm sorry, but it's just made-up crap. If somehow, you know, your religious myth that goes back 2,000 years, therefore it's legit because it's that old that it must be legit or whatever, that's fine. I won't pick on you for that. But if all of a sudden some guy discovered the rapture in the 19th century, then nah, it's just made up and it's silly and it ain't right. And then the other thing is, of course, that it's 2013 already, man. The odometer already flipped to 2013 years ago. All the predictions about, well, 50 years since the creation of Israel and all that have been up for 20 years now. And now even the whole Machu Picchu crap has come and gone too, right? Even the Mayan calendar thing is over. It's almost been a year since that failed to come true. If David Koresh and his followers had not all been murdered by the Delta Force, Army Combat Applications Group, Team B, acting on direct orders from Bill Clinton to kill them. If that had not happened, the killing of Koresh and his people, they would have been laughed right out of Mount Carmel by now for their predictions failing to come true. It's already over. It already didn't happen. Everybody already took their rapture sticker off their car. You know, in event of rapture, this car will be unmanned. They took it off because they thought it was going to happen back in 2003 or something, and then it didn't. And they finally gave up on that nonsense. Now it's 2013, and the truth is, you just live on a planet with the rest of us, and we're floating in space, and it's just a planet, man. There's nothing really magic about it. Sorry. But then, here's what's really hilarious, is over at the Huffington Post, they decide to take off after her, not so much for her religious beliefs that this is the end of the world, and not so much for the non sequitur that Obama funding Al-Qaeda in Syria, this minor policy point in an ocean of policy points, has anything to do with it whatsoever. I mean, it's not like she might as well have been saying, well, it's, you know, because we're in the fourth moon of Jupiter right now. Really? Well, what's the cause and effect there? What's the sec in the sequitur, man? Help me out, because I'm missing it. I thought we would know it was the end times because that was when the Chinese were going to pour into Israel, because that's what John Hagee said. Right? Because who else could the multi-million man atheist army possibly be? Not the Muslims. So I guess that must be the Chi-Coms, right? I thought we were waiting for that. What the hell does bankrolling the Mujahideen in Syria have to do with the end times? Other than, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean region, sort of generally speaking. Well, I didn't listen to the whole interview. But anyway, that wasn't even the Huffington Post's point either. You know what their point was? Is, what are you talking about? Barack Obama is not funding terrorists in Syria. That's the craziest thing Michelle Bachmann ever said, apparently, according to the Huffington Post. And then they quote Right Wing Watch. And then, this has got to be the funniest thing. This almost sounds like it was written by Bill Clinton or something. All right, check it out. So here's the quote of the why Bachmann was wrong, right? It's not anything like denial of Darbyite interpretations of the King James Version of the New Testament, and nothing like a questioning of the cause and effect, even assuming the premise there. And how the jihad thing has any indication other than what are you talking about? Any more than any other fact in the world you could point at. You know, shortstop burgers ain't what they used to be. That's a sign of the end times too. But anyway, here's what they say. The Minnesota congresswoman referred to a decision by the Obama administration to allow vetted Syrian rebels not affiliated with terrorist organizations to help them resist chemical weapons attacks, which was spurred by the Syrian regime's use of chemical weapons on civilians. While the administration's move is only related to non-lethal defensive and protective aid, Bachman falsely claimed that President Obama waived a ban on selling arms to terrorists. But of course, that's exactly what he did. Was waive a ban on transferring of arms. And this whole time, by the way, never even mind that. As everyone in the whole wide world knows, the CIA, on direct orders from Lord Obama, has been, at the very least, coordinating the bankrolling and arming of the Syrian Mujahideen for 2 years. So anyway, let's see what their link is. Statement by National Security Council spokesperson on the presidential determination. Oh no, we're just giving them mop gear. Yep, we're just giving them, plastic suits like they wear on Breaking Bad. Well, you know what? Let me see here. I should have gotten this ready for you already. And you know what? When I Google for Obama waiver, I have to exclude child soldiers because he passed a waiver on that, too. So I don't want to get my Google search confused. He's still back. Child soldiers. You know, with the waiver. And everything. And then, let me see here. There's a bunch of crap. Let me add antiwar.com so I can get the real version here. All right, here's the anti-war. Oh yeah, here it's John Glazer. From the Washington Examiner. President Obama waived a provision of federal law designed to prevent the supply of arms to terrorist groups to clear the way for U.S. to provide military assistance to, quote, vetted opposition groups fighting Syrian dictator Bashar Assad. Some elements of the Syrian opposition are associated with radical Islamist groups, including Al-Qaeda, etc. The president, citing his authority under the Arms Export Control Act, announced today he would waive the prohibitions in Sections 40 and 40A of the AECA related to such a transaction. Glazer writes, despite claims of a robust vetting process rebels must go through to be eligible for U.S. arms, Mother Jones reported just last week, which would be, 3 weeks ago now, that the process is shoddy and easily overcome by disparate rebel officers less concerned with Washington's vetting process, looking to get as many arms as possible. Moreover, a recent study by the defense consultancy corporation IHS Jane's found that nearly half of the approximately 100,000 rebel fighters are Islamist. And see, that's nothing because... I just got to click a few links. And I will get you to the Washington Post piece. Which says here, largest Syrian rebel groups form Islamic alliance. Impossible blow to U.S. influence. Yeah, in other words, all of the biggest of the so-called moderate groups, backed by the CIA, went and joined up with Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The Islamist Alliance, they call it. And, you know, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda hiding out in Pakistan somewhere, had put out a thing warning the Islamists to not get in bed with the CIA-backed groups, man. Well, he didn't have to worry, because all the CIA-backed groups got into bed with them. They had to. Come on. Moderates, that is, Syrians loyal to Washington first, they're not going to go die in this thing for Washington, D.C. The stateless volunteers who are willing to die in this thing are the ones who are dying for each other, who are dying for their beliefs, not dying for CIA bankrolls, their fat guts hanging over there. That was actually one of the, no offense to fat people in the audience, but this was on the Washington Post piece about, well, they're trying to double down on training the non-jihadist rebels now as best they can. And the picture is this guy weighs 250 pounds, none of it muscle, on a pile of debris, aiming his rifle up over his head, firing it blind. Or no, I guess he's just holding it. That was somebody else firing it blind in a different picture, sorry. But anyway, and then the caption is, FSA rebel fighter. Yeah, I'm sure he's a real badass, this guy. He looks like a deputy sheriff of Williamson County or something. Couldn't hop one fence. Couldn't run 100 yards. 50. I'm sure he's the ultimate warrior over there. And anyway, so, you know, Philip Giraldi reported on antiwar.com back in, and he was the first with this, back, it would have been December the 7th or December the 8th. I'm thinking the 7th. December the 7th, 2011, he said there are two brand new findings. A finding is an order by the president to the Central Intelligence Agency to go ahead and break the law. It's an order for covert action. Do what thou wilt. That kind of thing. Which, you know, and have a lot of fun doing it. And there was a new finding by the president that ordered an escalation of covert activity, of covert warfare against Iran and Syria both. And that was the starting of the funding of the thing. And you could just read in the New York Times and the Washington Post if you are, you know, terrified of any media any further afield than that. You have to keep all of your sources and your opinions within the goalposts of establishment authority. Yeah, well, they say so too. Even the Post and the Times say that, yeah, the U.S. has been running a covert campaign in Syria this whole time, working especially with the Turks, the Jordanians, the Qataris, and the Saudis to bankroll and arm the war. And yes, they attempt to vet those that they train. But as Glazer was pointing out in that thing I just read to you, they're not vetting who they arm and fund. They outsource all that to the local commanders. There's no vetting going on whatsoever. They don't have any, you know, or very little real intelligence on the ground of their own. They outsource it all. And the degree to which they're vetting the guys that come to train and pick up the guns in Turkey and in Jordan is what, you know? Well, he shaved his beard and he said he liked pop music. Here's some rifles and some money. You know? But meanwhile, even the degree to which they'd been trying that for the last couple of years is all rendered moot by this giant new alliance where the so-called moderates have all gotten into bed with Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq. And yeah, there are rivalries and they're fighting each other, some of the different groups, but anyway, I just think it's funny how probably, if you just search Syria rebels on the Huffington Post, they've run a hell of a lot of articles about all of this themselves. But then they'll turn around and pretend like this is the craziest thing that Bachman ever said, right? Not that the end of the world is nigh. Not that Obama's support for the Mujahideen in Syria is proof that the end of the world is nigh. But that Obama's supporting the Mujahideen in Syria. Yeah, that's just lunacy, huh? Whatever you say, guys. And now, here's what's most notable about this, how not notable it is. To me, anyway. Among thorny legal questions of Al-Qaeda suspect's capture, does holding him at sea violate the Geneva Convention? By Hannah Lam at McClatchy, this guy, Abu Anas al-Libi, the guy that they, I guess they claim Delta Force grabbed him, the Waco killers, grabbed him in Libya over the weekend, and they were holding him on a ship at sea. Just like the Bush guys did. The Bush regime used to have the CIA hold people on ships at sea, too. And then, so the thing is, this guy's already been indicted. And so the question is, wait, is he an enemy combatant, or is he a criminal suspect? And there's a debate about this, the laws of war and how they apply to this situation. And the most notable thing about it to me is like, it's all so old hat. I mean, if I wasn't so desensitized, I guess what I would have to say would be, he must be brought back to America and delivered up in front of a civilian black-robed judge for his habeas corpus immediately. But, I guess I'm just even I, and I got a disorder where I don't get desensitized to this stuff, and yet, yeah, I'm desensitized. I wouldn't be surprised to find out if they were torturing him. Yes, he's already been indicted for his role, alleged role, in the 98 Africa embassy bombings. No statute of limitations on hundreds of counts of murder, bud. Laters for you. But then shouldn't he be tried in Tanzania? Or I don't know, they were against American targets, fine. So try him in New York or in Virginia. See if I care. But what are they doing? They're trying to have it both ways. They're gonna hold him on a ship and interrogate him without a lawyer until they're done and then turn him over to the justice system, or they're gonna send him to Guantanamo now. It's sort of like during the Bush years with these Obama guys. It's sort of hit and miss. It's like, they prosecute Lind in court, but they put Hamdi in Guantanamo. They prosecute Moussaoui in court, but they put Padilla and Omari in CIA and military custody. You know? So it was more bureaucratic infighting that determines these things than, you know, any pretension of the rule of law, I guess. So who's going to win, the Attorney General or the Secretary of Defense? Are they the ones fighting over this guy? And by the way, they're saying about him in The Guardian, I think. Yeah, here it is. The Guardian, they say, man, this guy was disillusioned with jihadism. He hadn't been palling around with Al-Qaeda and all them in forever. They could have just had him arrested. He was just walking around the streets of Tripoli. They could have had him arrested by the local pretended authorities, but no, they had to do a big Delta Force raid. If you want to be the slightest bit cynical and suspicious about it, just to pick a fight. Just to get people angry at the U.S. so they have more people to kill in Libya. Oh, the brand new start of further American intervention in Libya. And this was all the riot yesterday on CNN, was more Marines being moved to Italy within striking distance, of course, just across the sea there. And, you know, this was supposed to be my interview on Saturday Sunday for the KPFK show was going to be David Vine on his new piece for Time Dispatch about the escalation of the buildup of American military forces in Italy. And it's a lot. And there's a full-scale invasion of Africa coming. Good luck, Africa. We're coming to kill you. Sorry. But you've got stuff for stealing. You got stuff that the Chinese want to buy from you. So we're going to have to kill you to keep them out. I hope you understand. It's just full-spectrum dominance and benevolent global hegemony. I mean, for those of you who survive, you'll see the benevolence. It'll be great. But yeah, that's what's great about American foreign policy is history always began yesterday. So you can talk about, yeah, the Mujahideen is a problem in Libya for some reason now, everybody. We got to go to Libya. Oh, yeah, the Mujahideen, they're a problem now in Syria for some reason that nobody could put their finger on. Nobody's quite sure why, but all of a sudden history started and there are jihadists running around in Syria doing things. In fact, I think here's probably the first real move that toward the redirection, perhaps another redirection in Syria. LA Times, U.S. fears radical Islamists could take root in Syria. Are they going to go back to the Bush policy of backing Bashar al-Assad and paying him to torture Jabhat al-Nusra and Islamic State of Iraq guys for us? Is Barack Obama going to pull a giant Bay of Pigs on the rebels he's been supporting the last 2 years and then turn around and back Assad? At least that would be consistent with a war against Al-Qaeda. Right now, we're fighting the Shiites because that's what Israel wants. The Iran, Iraq, Syria, Hezbollah axis of Shia must be confronted because that's what Benjamin Netanyahu says. And so our government is backing Al-Qaeda against the Shia. But that doesn't make much sense, does it? Not since it was the Al-Qaeda guys that knocked our towers down, not Hezbollah. Anyway. U.S. fears radical Islamists could take root in Syria. I wonder if Obama is going to backtrack and go back to the terror war in Libya, too. Here's one in Al Jazeera, Libya, a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. It's like I told you 2 years ago, two and a half years ago. Can't let the guys we're fighting for win.
Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's a beautiful day here in Austin, Texas. Too bad for you, you're not here. Or maybe some of you are, in which case, congratulations. I love October in Austin. My very favorite. All right. Well, enough chit-chat about the weather. We got to go to our first guest. It's the great Jim Loeb from Interpress Service. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for Interpress Service. And I'm going to go ahead and call him the world's foremost expert on the neoconservative movement. Welcome to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us on the show again. And it's been way, way, way too long since we've spoken. And actually, I was thinking about that during the break there, waiting to bring you up, and it occurred to me that you really helped set me straight on just what a neoconservative is way back in 2003, because I was a bit confused by the fact that John Bolton and Pat Robertson and Newt Gingrich were palling around at the American Enterprise Institute, and I thought maybe neocon meant a conservative that hangs around at the American Enterprise Institute. But you set it straight, set me straight all about how this is really a biographical term. It doesn't mean a conservative nowadays, like Sean Hannity or something. It means what exactly, Jim? Could you fill us in?
Well, on what it means. Well, I think it's more of a, it's not a kind of internally consistent ideology. It's much more of a kind of worldview or mindset, and it comes out of the late 1960s when a not insignificant portion of the Jewish community decided, kind of reevaluated its positions on foreign policy and became much more Israel-focused and much more devoted to the security, however defined, of Israel. This, I think, was especially the result of the 1967 war. Most of this community was pretty secular in orientation. They weren't particularly religious, but they did identify very strongly culturally and ethnically with their heritage, and Israel became very much a focus of that. And there was basically a kind of major readjustment in which their foreign policy views became increasingly Israel-centered. And as Israel moved to the right in the 1970s, they did as well. I would say it's not entirely Israel-centered. Well, it is pretty entirely Israel-centered. I think Israel is a core interest, or the security of Israel is a core interest of neoconservatives. But they also believe very strongly that the United States has a kind of historic role of protecting Israel. And therefore, they identified increasingly with a kind of aggressive U.S. nationalism and exceptionalism, which believe that the United States, the greater the power the United States exerts in the world, the better off everyone, and particularly Israel, would be. Now, it's by no means limited to Jews. There are many Christian Zionists who have pretty much accepted a neoconservative worldview, and a number of aggressive nationalists like Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, John Bolton, and others also have kind of cross-fertilized and pretty much adopted the neoconservative vision of what U.S. foreign policy should be, although there are obvious differences of opinion, even on specific issues. For example, neoconservatives have themselves split over U.S. involvement in Syria, whether aid should be cut off to Egypt because of the military coup there. I mean, they have differences both among neoconservatives and with their non-neoconservative but close allies, like the aggressive nationalists such as John Bolton, and occasionally even Christian Zionists.
Right, but you don't call somebody like Bolton a neoconservative. You might say he believes in neoconservatism a bit, but you also write about it as a very small movement, a very small group of people, not just the ideas, but, you know, like in your great piece, All in the Neocon Family, where we're really only talking about a few dozen men and women who have this extremely inordinate amount of influence on newspaper editorial pages and in think tanks and in government positions, but that they're, you know, at most all, you know, cousin-in-laws or something.
Well, yeah, I suppose, I mean, there are families that are associated very closely with neoconservatism from the beginning, such as the Crystal family or the Podhoretz-Dechter family. To some extent, the Abrams, Elliot Abrams, who overlaps with the Podhoretz family and so on. They do have a political base, but it's a very in the Jewish community, but it's a minority of American Jews. I think it's definitely a minority of American Jews. But you know, they have largely this network of probably several dozen people, thinkers in institutions like American Enterprise Institute, really have dominated the foreign policy views of the Republican Party, at least through since the mid-90s, during the post-Cold War era. And I think their domination is increasingly contested by other parts of the party. But their voice is very loudly heard in Washington, and they're a very effective network.
All right, now we've been talking a lot on this show and with a lot of different experts all about the hopefulness and the possibility of some real talks with Iran about their nuclear program and what I think pretty much everybody recognizes as the basic outlines of the deal: stop enriching up to 20% and we'll lift some sanctions and these kinds of things. And it seems like everybody is, you know, if they're not hopeful, everybody would at least like to be hopeful about this, except I think you've gone through and cataloged here, and it's the neoconservative movement are probably the only people in the world that you could find who are outright lamenting the possibility of a breakthrough on an end to the Cold War between the United States and Iran. Jim, what in the world?
Well, it's not surprising. I would add, I would say Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, who in many respects is a kind of classic neoconservative, although he himself is Israeli, also is very, very concerned about the possibility of détente or even a rapprochement between the United States and Iran, and neoconservatives very much reflect his views. But of course, because the Israeli government is so distrustful of such a prospect, the larger Israel lobby, which is much bigger than the neoconservatives, I think is also quite concerned. Although I think there's also dissension within the lobby itself about how to react to Rouhani and his diplomatic offensive and kind of Iran's new post-Ahmadinejad look. So it's not just the neoconservatives. They are particularly outspoken in their, well, what I call kind of despair at the prospect that after all this time, Iran and the United States may actually be moving to substantially ease tensions, if not achieve some kind of rapprochement.
Yeah. You know, I've always kind of been, you know, just a tiny bit nervous about stating that from the point of view of the war party, the moderates in Iran are the enemy, because they would rather have extremists to confront, because, you know, really, it just seems that way to me. I don't really know that, but no, really, here he is, Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal, saying exactly that, as you quote him here, saying Israel is now in the disastrous position of having to hope, and that means he is too, that Iranian hardliners will sabotage President Rouhani's efforts to negotiate a deal.
Well, I think hardliners in both countries have always relied on their colleagues in the other country to keep tensions high. And there definitely is a strong kind of affinity between neoconservatives in this country and what are frankly called neoconservatives in Iran also, the most hardline sectors in Iran, because they reinforce each other's position. The more influence hardliners in the United States exercising their influence through the U.S. Congress primarily can show that the United States is not interested in détente with Iran, that the United States wants regime change in Iran, then the stronger the position of the hardliners in Iran, who say you shouldn't even make an effort at negotiating an agreement with the United States because the United States is our our sworn enemy, or the great Satan, if you will. Both hardliners on both sides feed each other very strongly.
Mm. All right, so this one's a two-parter. How serious do you think Obama is about this? I mean, as far as how hard is he willing to push to make Congress go along and, you know, that kind of thing, do you think? And can the neocons and their Republican allies stop him, do you think?
Well, I think it's difficult to assess. I mean, clearly Obama, and it looks increasingly like Secretary of State John Kerry, and I think for certain Chuck Hagel, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, all would like to see a nuclear deal. I think one of the obvious questions is, how hard are they going to push for one? How much political capital are they willing to spend in order to get one? Because going against the Israel lobby in particular and its allies in Congress, which are many, many on both sides of the aisle, will require a high political cost. You know, one thing you can criticize Obama about is that he has never fought very, very hard on a major issue. He tends to think that once he states the case and states it rationally, that everyone should more or less kind of understand his points and hopefully accept them. But he's not a politician in the sense that he likes to make the same point over and over again and fight and fight and fight and fight. Whereas the lobby and certainly the neoconservatives, not to mention Israel itself, or the Israeli government, will fight very, very hard because they feel that any kind of rapprochement between the United States and Iran is a zero-sum game in which they're going to lose. And in some respects, they're also backed by the Saudis and the United Arab Republics and a couple other Gulf states who also feel threatened by such a detente, the possibility of a detente, although they're much less vocal and much less powerful in Washington D.C. They still will insist that their voice be heard, at least in the inner councils of government. I think the other problem is that whereas Obama, Hagel, and Kerry, I think, would really like to reach a deal, very much want one. Will the bureaucrats who kind of run the sanctions program and who are constantly looking for ways to make it more difficult for Iran, just as a bureaucratic proposition, they're the ones who will be charged with implementing the policy. And how zealously and loyally they implement it is also a major question in that's relevant at this point. As we go into these talks. And I think, you know, on the Iranian side, they face, Rouhani and Zarif face similar problems with various bureaucracies and entrenched interests in Tehran who do not want to see a rapprochement. The situation is pretty symmetrical, and the question is whether the leaders will have the power and determination to really create a new relationship, reach a deal on nukes, which could open up a lot of possibilities for regional cooperation mm-hmm. at a level we haven't seen, at least since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan back 12 years ago now.
Right. Well, now, I wonder if, do you think it's bad politics for the Israelis and the Israel lobby to be so far out in front of the American people on all of these wars, pushing for... They were the only voice, I guess, in D.C. other than Obama's pushing for the strikes against Syria. And now here they're blatantly, you know, calling for the sabotage of any peace talks with Iran, which 75% of the American people support and want a peaceful resolution to any outstanding issues there. And I just wonder whether they're gambling, whether it's a reasonable gamble they're making or not, of costing themselves the goodwill of the American people at this point. I mean, most Americans don't even know about the Israel lobby at all. And they seem to be guaranteeing that as the American people become aware of it, it's only in the context of, yeah, they're always trying to push us into a war.
Well, I think that's probably the source of some internal debate within the various institutions that make up the lobby, is how far out in front to be seen as perpetuating a policy of confrontation that could indeed eventually lead to war. I'm sure there's some unease about it, especially in the wake of Syria. On the other hand, I think they think that Iran is a different proposition from Syria in that the hostility that's been built up against Iran is of much, much greater longstanding. Iran consistently ranks as one of the most, you know, unfriendly nations as far as the American public is concerned, and has for decades. And I think that affects...
That's true. They're a lot bigger adversary to take on, too, though. But anyway, all right, we're all out of time. Thanks very much, Jim. I sure appreciate your time on the show. Good to talk to you again.
Sure is. So long, Scott.
All right, that is Jim Loeb. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of Interpress Service, IPSnews.net, and the world's foremost expert on the neocons. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. So listen, there used to be such a thing as the Neoconservatism Archive of Jim Loeb, of just Jim Loeb, not everybody ever at IPS News. It was just Jim Loeb's Neoconservatism Archive, and he had articles in there going back to the 1970s, and his keeping track of these guys all the way from the 1970s all the way through today, through all what they were up to in the Reagan years and everything. Great stuff. I mean, if you could measure web pages and their weight in platinum and things like that, we're talking better than that. Because, see, I don't want it to just ring hollow when I say that Jim Loeb is the world's foremost expert on the neoconservatives, because, of course, he hasn't, I don't believe he's written any books about them. But that's okay. He's been writing articles about them for 35 years. So, let me see here. Jay provides a link for us. Well, this is a good article, but no. There's an archive, I'm telling you. It's got hundreds of articles in it. And it's not just everything Jim ever wrote either. It's just everything Jim ever wrote specifically about the neoconservatives. And it goes back to the 70s. This is going to take some real, you know, data crunching, man. This is not going to be an easy Google search, because I'm searching, you know, site IPSnews.net for it right now, and I still ain't finding it. It's there somewhere, man. It's got to be. And, you know, I've had this problem in the past. It's been years now. But there was a time when I could always find it if I was looking for it, because I was studying it, you know? I was going through there. And what happened was I ended up no longer able to find this thing. This should be, let me see here. What you do is you go site colon, and then you don't need a HTTP or anything. You just go site colon IPSnews.net. Loeb, neoconservatives. But then all I'm getting is, oh, wait, is this it right here? Ta-da! Wait, neocons. Wait, how far back does this go? Does it have a... It's got a next page, but it doesn't have a last page button. This may be it right here. IPSnews.net/topics/neocons with a dash in neocons. I don't know why they put a dash in neocons. It's a compound word, man. Go ahead. Man, it's too bad that it doesn't have, you know, numbers of pages and whether, you know, go ahead and go to the last one. Well, let's see. Page 3, what happens if I say page 33? Or, well, let's try 23 first. Yeah, see, here we go. Page 23. And this is only Bush years stuff. So then what if I go page 43? Nope, no 43. Okay, so how about 38. No, not negative on the 38. All right, let's try 32. Wait, we already did 33, right? No, we did the 20s. Yeah, there's 34. Anyway, well, no, I want to know. Not anyway. I want to know, don't you? Is this it or isn't it? So there's 35. And there's 36. It ends at 36. And then, no, this is not the full archive, kids, because this is only going back to 1997. And that's pretty good. If you want to read about the neocons since 1997. Here's one from 98. here he is, all about regime change in Iraq in 1998. Good old Jim Loeb. But anyway, no, somewhere. I know it, because I remember in my brain, with my brain, that there is an archive of Jim Loeb on the neocons that goes all the way back to the 1970s and 1980s. And I think they skip a few years in the 80s there. But they're still, they go all the way back. But I don't see them here. These only go back to 98. But anyway, there's 36 pages of articles. I mean, this is title, first, you know, lead, subtitle. Title, subtitle. About, I don't know, a dozen per page for 36 pages. On the neoconservatives. That's ipsnews.net/topics/neo-cons. Okay? ipsnews.net, just like you were going to read Gareth Porter or Adam Morrow. ipsnews.net/topics. That makes sense, right? Topics. You know, like a topic. ipsnews.net/topics/neocons. And then, of course, you have to remember that the IPS News way of doing things is to always put a dash in neocons for no reason at all. So that's how to make the web address come right up for you there. Or you could do, like I neglected to do the first time, but remembered to do the second time, and that is you do site colon ipsnews.net Loeb neocons. And then you don't even need the dash there because it's a Google search and they'll account for that for you. And it'll blam it right up for you if you do it like that. Okay, good. So there's, even though that does not apparently go back to the 1970s, it is 36 pages worth of archives. And I bet if you were to just sit and do like the Lawnmower Man and download all of Jim Loeb's information into your brain by way of your eyeball holes, you could probably finish in a day or two, you know, if you worked hard at it, and then maybe take a few notes, and then you'll be a genius on the neocons. You'll know who they all are, and who married whose cousin to over there at the Winnep. Yeah. All right, hey, Jason Leopold's coming up in, a few minutes. I guess I have 45 seconds to say something. I should say something. I need to go get car insurance today. Sorry, I'm looking at my notes. That's all it says. Oh, this is important. Go read it in the Wall Street Journal. If you don't have a code or whatever to get into the Wall Street Journal, what you do is put it in Google News, and then it'll let you click through and read it. It's called Iran Readies Offer to Limit Its Nuclear Program. And it's what we all thought, and it's what is more than reasonable. Yeah, the URL, ipsnews.net/topics/neocons with a dash. ipsnews.net/topics/neocons with a dash in neocons. All right, we'll be right back. Jason Leopold in a second.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.
All right, do your job, Horton. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's my show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. That's why I named the show the Scott Horton Show. Well, what am I gonna name it? Something else? Say it ain't so. Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. 3,000 interviews and counting now. At scotthorton.org, and you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. Please do. All right. Next up is our friend Jason Leopold. Now he's writing for Al Jazeera. And
Al Jazeera America.
I'm umming as I click on it so I get the URL right. America.aljazeera.com, which is different than, I guess, Qatar.aljazeera.com, huh?
It is different in the sense that you can actually get Al Jazeera America here, but you have to, in order to get, you know, Qatar Al Jazeera, you have to go to the bottom of the America page and look for the link that says visit Al Jazeera English, if you can find it, and click that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I still actually contribute to Al Jazeera English as well. And, in fact, I had a story out there, related to Guantanamo just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, which is why I'm angry, because I couldn't find it in the Google News. All it would pull up for me was this one. Human rights group says Obama has failed on Guantanamo, which, you know, duh, and everything. We need to talk about that. But I wanted to talk about this article that I lost from the other day about how they finally gave you the documents that you'd been suing them for that they had denied to you previously. They finally fessed up and gave them to you. Am I correct? And they had denied them, saying that you're trying to reveal sources and methods that would help Al-Qaeda attack Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
That's right, yeah. They denied it. And that was the argument they made in court, Scott, that, you know, the government and the warden, the commander of the Joint Detention Group, Colonel John Bogdan, you know, they went to court and they said that this information in the declaration, I was seeking the declaration that he filed in response to a lawsuit revolving around those genital searches. We spoke about it before. And he said that, look, if this is revealed, we don't know what will happen. Al-Qaeda could attack. And they were very clear about that. They made that the you know, the main focal point. And, you know, when you say that and you're a judge, for the most part, they just say, okay, you know, national security is at risk. We really don't want to argue with you. So that's why this was, this is actually kind of a rare victory. Because that argument usually, you know, holds up, and the government often makes these national security type arguments to block the release of information. Well, not this time. And the 2 weeks ago, the judge in the case, Judge Royce Lamberth, he found in my favor, and he issued an opinion that based a pretty nice opinion that said that, you know, the government just failed to, you know, demonstrate how this would, you know, actually result in that type of action or threat. They're simply just making these statements. And so he ordered that declaration unsealed and gave the government 2 weeks to appeal. And I was actually kind of sure that they would appeal, but the 2 weeks elapsed and they didn't, and he unsealed the declaration. So there's two things. One, I have to say that it's a pretty sweet victory, a sweet victory for transparency, and I'm very happy that I was able to sort of, you know, get this unsealed so I can report what these Al-Qaeda threats are, Scott.
Right.
And you know, in the story I lay out what the security issues are that could lead Al-Qaeda to attack Guantanamo, and it's pretty serious.
Yeah, they, I mean, what, they're going to sail their navy and invade the place and spring everybody, right?
Well, this is basically what was previously redacted. Prison guards drive, and this is, again, this is the security, you know, issue here. Prison guards drive Ford C-350 cargo vans. That's one. Mm-hmm. The other is that they are strapped in with seatbelts. The vans have, there's no windows in the back. And then there is, he goes into detail about exactly how that genital search is conducted. So I'm not sure how, you know, Al-Qaeda will actually use that explosive info that, you know, was fought 3 months for, you know, that the government went to court using taxpayer dollars to, you know, block this from coming out. But that's the info that they were worried about Al-Qaeda using, you know, perhaps mounting an attack. And the attorneys, and you know, who represent the prisoners, who filed a motion in support of, you know, my motion to intervene to get this info, you know, just tore the tore apart the arguments by the government and the warden.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like they were trying his patience. This judge actually was, I guess that's the only time you can get him to decide the right thing, is if they kind of take personal offense at the shoddiness of the argument deployed by the state, something like that, huh?
Yeah, no, and you know, Royce Lamberth is actually, you know, one of those rare judges out there in D.C. who's actually found or has ruled in favor of not just transparency, but, you know, finding that the Guantanamo lawyers have made good arguments. You know, the way that it works these days, Scott, is that government goes to court and gets everything it wants, certainly as it relates to Guantanamo. So there's it's usually over and done with rather, you know, not necessarily rather quickly, but it's you know, they go in, they make their arguments, they put it under seal. We don't get to see it. And this was just one of those instances where I just felt as a reporter that, you know, I just returned from Guantanamo. They put on this show to show us how well this prison is run. Okay. After I return, I get these documents, these other documents from the Freedom of Information Act request, showing in relation to the death of Adnan Latif, a Yemeni prisoner last September, that there has been widespread breakdown of safeguards at Guantanamo, just across the board. Every standard operating procedure, you know, apparently has not been followed. And as a result, it led to the death of this prisoner. And then you have this lawsuit, and they're blocking this. And I said, you know, I this is one of those times where I have to go beyond the Freedom of Information Act. What can I do to get this info? And I mean, I think that this is, you know, what the document shows, you know, in terms of what those unredacted parts are, it's unbelievable that this is what they're blocking, and or this is what they, you know, were arguing should remain sealed. And it obviously raises questions about, well, what else out there is, you know, what else are they concealing that, you know, when you take a look at it, it's like, really? The Ford C350 cargo vans you didn't want? That's what you were, you know, blocking?
Well, no, I mean, that's the whole thing, is what they're keeping secret is the important part lumped in there with all the nonsense. The nonsense is the excuse to keep secret their policy of patting everybody down, which is just a thin pretext to keep them in their cells away from their lawyers.
Right, and then that's actually what Lambert said in his opinion when he ruled in favor of you know, the attorneys and actually ordered this policy banned. You know, the government appealed it. So, you know, now it, you know, that this declaration has been unsealed, we get to see exactly what they're doing, how many times they're doing it. So, you know, I think that this is a you know, it's very important on many different levels. It's important, first of all, to have this on, you know, the public record as you know, documents out there. It's important for transparency. It's important for, you know, also I think for journalists, other journalists, to see, look, you know, there are it's very challenging to do our jobs, particularly as it pertains to Guantanamo. I can call up these spokespeople every day, and they're great people. I like them. I mean, they're genuinely nice people. I could call them up every day and get a whatever comment, but it's not going to tell me or tell you or tell your listeners or tell my readers what they need to know. So I think this action is, you know, another way to try and get information. And you know, that's its own sort of separate, you know, story there. But it's, you know, it's an important one because this is sort of the environment that we live in now, where, you know, information is now so closely guarded that everything, you know, is being protected, you know, for due to, you know, whatever national security threat. And actually what we're seeing is that the information isn't, you know, a national security threat. It's just that they feel like they don't want to reveal the info because it's embarrassing. And guess what? That info that's in the story that you'll see there toward the bottom of the story, where I describe, you know, the other things that were in that declaration that was sealed. I mean, it's you could see why they would feel that it's embarrassing. They're going through and talking about how they, you know, have to you know, put a hand near the buttocks and genital groin area, you know, to search. So they just didn't want anyone to know that. And I think that that's very, I think that's ultimately what this all came down to. It's just amazing that they went to court to do it.
Yeah. Well, and I think more importantly, further than that, is they know that whatever percentage of these guys will just absolutely refuse to go along with that and will stay in their cell and not go meet with their lawyer. And apparently that was what the whole thing was even about. It wasn't, you know, the suicide pills or whatever is just a pretext for carrying out this procedure that's meant to keep these people from, you know, refusing to undergo the humiliation required to see their lawyer and plan their defense.
Right, that's true. And, you know, it happened at the height of the hunger strike in April, where there were about 100 prisoners on hunger strike, you know, dozens being force-fed. And now that the hunger strike, at least the way the media says it, is essentially over, even though there's more than a dozen still on hunger strike, they're apparently not conducting these, you know, these searches. Now that majority of the prisoners are back to communal living, and attorneys are going down there, they're apparently not, you know, enforcing this. They're not going through with it. So that just gets back to what, you know, as you were saying, that this clearly was a deterrent. This was a, or at least, look, I don't have the smoking gun that says it was, but I'll at least go with what the judge says. Judge Lambert actually said that this was a policy, you know, enacted to block the prisoners' access to counsel. So, you know, that happened in April when all of these stories, I mean, this was a, this, these were, there were global, you know, stories on a global scale pertaining to Guantanamo and the hunger strike and force feeding. Right. And where were we getting those stories? I was getting those stories from the attorneys who were sharing their notes from meeting with the prisoners. So you sort of cut that out, and then you no longer have any stories to tell if the prisoners aren't going there, you know, aren't meeting with their attorneys. Now, it seems that, you know, that the hunger strike has died down, that it's not being covered. Well, look, you know, this policy is now not really being enforced.
Well, what's the big deal? What do you expect? It's communist Cuba.
Right.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. We're talking about on the American side of the wall. Oops.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I do have a problem with that then. Yeah. Anyway, by the way, how many people are still hunger striking down there?
There's 17 hunger strikers, and there are 16 who are designated for force feeding.
Poor guys, they can't even get me to pay attention to them down there. They're starving themselves to death, and it's just old news all over the world. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was last spring.
Yeah, no, it's look, the it's been going on for, you know, 9 months. And the a few weeks ago, you know, we received the media, you know, received this note from, you know, the folks over at Guantanamo saying that they're not going to report any more daily hunger strike numbers. And so because they were doing that about, I think, around March. I think they started it in March as a hunger strike grew. And, you know, they kept getting these phone calls from the media, how many people are on hunger strike today? How many people are on hunger strike today? So what they would do is they sent out to the media every day sort of this is the, you know, the stats. These are the hunger strike stats. And you know, you during the height of the hunger strike, you just watched it sort of increase and increase and increase. And so a few weeks ago, they said, we're not going to, you know, do this anymore. The number of hunger strikers now, we believe, are part of the sort of long-term hunger striking team or group at Guantanamo, which is, you know, there were always a handful that were on hunger strike. And so they believe that those that are sort of involved in it now, they're just part of a long-term hunger striking group. So the media took that and said the hunger strike is over, you know, is essentially over. Now, you know, the folks at Guantanamo never said the hunger strike is over. They just, you know, said that they're not going to report this every day. And, you know, we could certainly still make phone calls and find out what's happening. So the media sort of, like, you could tell with some of the reporting, they felt like, as you said, hey, this is old news. It's, you know, earlier in the year, not going to do it anymore. So they sort of, you know, irresponsibly, in my opinion, sort of ended it. And, you know, again, a couple of weeks ago, I also published at Al Jazeera America this first time anything like it has been published. It's a multimedia guide to 11 years of hunger strikes at Guantanamo. And what I found, Scott, in reporting this and putting together these, you know, these numbers from literally, like, you know, just the first week of prisoners arriving there at Guantanamo, is that there was never an end. So you'd have the hunger strikes being reported, but there was never an end. There was never a time where the media would just follow it, constantly follow it, until there was a point where you could say that, you know, either there's zero hunger striking or we're going to end it here with five. So it always fell off, and that was actually a frustrating part of it, is that, you know, in terms of kind of understanding how the media operated. You know, it's as if they only, you know, pay attention when there's, and I understand it. I mean, you know, you have 100 prisoners hunger striking. It's a very big deal, but it would just sort of, you know, trail off after a while, and you wouldn't be able to sort of figure out, when did this hunger strike end? It started in August of 2005. What's the end date? What happened? So it was, you know, putting that timeline together was difficult. But it was actually, that's what I found. That's what I learned from, you know, from doing it.
I completely missed this when it came out. I got it in front of me now, everybody. It's your keywords here. Interactive hunger strikes at Guantanamo at America.aljazeera.com by Michael Keller and Jason Leopold. And this is really something else. I can't wait to look at this.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's incredible how many have been just hunger striking for, you know, just the past 5 or 6 years.
Right, and look, like, I don't want to divert the whole conversation off on this because it's been a proven fact a million times over, and including in interviews between you and I, but the 99% of those guys are completely innocent, just the kidnapped. And then, of course, it ain't Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib starving themselves to death, which would be fine with me. It's the rest of these guys who are they're that desperate because they're innocent. That's why, you know, it's always doing time is always a lot harder on a guy who never should have been there in the first place than somebody who knows he done wrong and got what he deserved. You know what I mean? But anyway, so I wanted to ask you about a couple of guys got released back a week or two ago, right? Or did they just say that?
It was actually at the end of August. The end of August, there were two Algerian prisoners who were clear for release for years, and they were sent back to Algeria.
All right, and then do you know much about them, who they were, or what they were ever accused of? And the
yeah, I mean, basically, yeah, I do know their names. I mean, their names are out there. You'll have to forgive me because I don't have it in front of me. But they both were at Guantanamo for about a decade. And, again, just accused of being a member of Al-Qaeda, fighting, you know, training in these in training camps in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda training camps. And, you know, these were men that were more or less sold for bounties. So, you know, they were released to Algeria, which... In the past, when there was another prisoner released to Algeria, that prisoner protested, fearing that he would be tortured. We didn't hear anything about that this time. And, you know, one of the prisoners, his family is in France. And, you know, I believe he wanted to eventually, you know, go to France to, you know, reunite with his family. I don't have any confirmation of it, but there have been reports that France is saying that they're not accepting any more, you know, former Guantanamo prisoners. So that prisoner doesn't seem that, or it doesn't appear that he wanted to remain in Algeria. But, you know, it's unclear if they're in a rehabilitation program now, if they're, you know, simply just in prison. But they're not walking around freely at this point.
Yeah. Well, you can see how that'd be scary to be a former Guantanamo inmate sent home to Algeria and everybody looking at you. Why'd Obama let you go and not anybody else after all this time, right? You must have a chip in your ass.
Yeah. It's obviously must be a difficult life to leave, you know, afterward, readjusting.
Yeah, crazy. All right, and so now, but then also I read that a new bureaucrat has been appointed, and this is now finally the beginning of the end of the Guantanamo gulag.
Right, yeah. You know, Obama made this speech back. You know, this is what the human rights groups were really complaining about, was, you know, Obama made this big counterterrorism speech back in May, as you recall, and you know, talking about his, you know, drones and his plan for Guantanamo going forward. And what one thing that he talked about was that he was going to name these two envoys, one of the State Department, one of the Defense Department, work alongside each other to start releasing, repatriating, and, you know, transferring these 86 at the time prisoners who have been cleared for release for years. But they did name a State Department envoy, but they never named a Defense Department envoy. And and it's funny because the State Department position was vacant for months, and it was only as a result of this hunger strike that they finally filled it. So then it's sort of like reversed. Then you had the Defense Department position being vacant. So, you know, he named a former House counsel, worked on the, you know, for the Armed Services Committee. He's got, you know, decades of experience, a Marine, to start handling, you know, to be the point person at the Defense Department, to shut down Guantanamo. But look, I mean, I'll tell you, Scott, I don't believe that Guantanamo will be shut down. I think that that's just not, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that, you know, what we'll see, and we've talked about this before, is that they'll start emptying out the, you know, the prison in terms of getting rid of the 86, the 84 now, who have been cleared for release. But everyone else, I think that there's going to be at least, you know, a couple of dozen that they're just not going to have anywhere to put them. It's just they're not going to be able to shut that thing down.
Yeah, well, it's funny because it's been, 6, 7 years now since Robert Gates and Colin Powell and all the Republicans came out and said, man, we really need to undo this thing. This is the...
Yeah, but look,
the,
you know,
second
just
leading cause of terrorism in the world after radical Islam.
Right. Well, look, they...
Never mind any occupation of anybody's countries. That doesn't have anything
right,
to do with it.
Right, that has nothing to do with it. You know, don't even think about that, Scott.
Yeah, never mind that.
But look, this happens every time we catch a, you know, an accused terrorist, just like we did this weekend. One of the alleged, you know, planners involved in the, you know, the 1998 embassy bombings in Libya. And look, you know what happens? Oh, he's being held on a on the USS San Antonio, where he's being interrogated by this secretive high value interrogation group. And there's calls for, you know, send this guy to Guantanamo. Don't bring him here to the U.S. to be, you know, to be prosecuted, even though he was indicted in the Southern District of New York. So, you know, this happens every time. And who do we hear from? Oh, look, it's Lindsey Graham. He's saying the same thing again. So when you have that sort of attitude, when you have that as your typical response, and what do you have from the other side? No, we're not going to send any more people to Guantanamo. Yeah, it just shows that, you know, it's not in the, it's certainly not in the interest of, you know, of one party, you know, to completely shut it down. And I'll tell you that I know privately that there, you know, Democrats have, they're not really looking forward to bringing anyone here either. You know, Dianne Feinstein, when she made her big statements this summer about this is what we need to do, I mean, this is a woman who was just speaking out, you know, a senator is just speaking out simply because, you know, there was a hunger strike and it was bad publicity for the Democrats. You know, and the same with, you know, with her, you know, male counterparts in the Senate.
No intention to follow through, though.
No, because what happens, Scott, is that, you know, one of the reasons that these human rights groups sent this letter out on Monday criticizing Obama for sort of dragging his feet is that what happens now? The hunger strike is over. Well, do you think anyone's going to pay attention to Guantanamo anymore? Probably not. Will it be a priority? Unlikely.
It's so, all Congress's fault anyway. Yeah, the Republicans. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's so it's like they'll sit there and blame which, you know, you'll have the president blaming Congress. And look, you know, you're right. It still is very much a, you know, Guantanamo being used as as some sort of, you know, recruiting tool or something to hold up to say, you know, look. But it's just I think that it's good steps that they have these folks in these positions to start at least getting rid of the prisoners that are there.
All right. Well, we got to leave it there.
Love that theme music, brother.
Get some water to drink there, Jason. Thanks very much for doing the show. Appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, everybody. That's the great Jason Leopold. He's over there at America.AlJazeera.com. Check out interactive hunger strikes at Guantanamo and other great pieces of journalism there. See you tomorrow.